Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's International and National Security Law Practice Group, was recorded on Wednesday, August 13, 2014, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Good afternoon and welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group telephone conference call on surveillance, national security, and privacy, the PCLOB report on Section 702 surveillance. My name is Christian Corgan, and I'm Director of Publications at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call, and also that this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. And so without any further ado, I'm going to turn it over now to the moderator of today's call, Matthew Hyman, who is Vice President, Chief Compliance and Audit Officer at Tyco. So to introduce our speakers and the topic, Matthew, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Christian, and thanks to everyone for dialing in. We've got an interesting call today that is going to focus on a recent report that was issued by the Privacy and Civil Liberties Oversight Board related to Section 702 of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, or FISA Act, as it's called. This is the section that focuses on government collection of electronic communication content that relates to non-U.S. persons reasonably believed to be non-U.S. persons that are located out of the U.S. And we couldn't have two better panelists to walk us through the topic because they're both members of the PCLOB. The first one is Rachel Brand. Ms. Brand is a graduate of Harvard Law School, and she clerked for Justice Kennedy. Rachel held a number of positions at the U.S. Department of Justice during the George W. Bush administration, the last of those being Assistant Attorney General for Legal Policy. Currently, Rachel is the Vice President and Chief Counsel for Regulatory Litigation at the National Chamber Litigation Center, which is the litigation arm of the Chamber of Commerce. And Rachel, as I mentioned, is also a member of the PCLOB, and she today will be speaking as a member of the PCLOB. The second panelist we have today is also a Harvard Law School graduate. That's James Dempsey. After law school, Mr. Dempsey clerked for the Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court. He was an associate with the law firm of Arnold & Porter. He then served as the deputy director at the Nonprofit Center for the National Security Studies, and he was the special counsel to the National Security Archive. Since 1997, Mr. Dempsey has been with the Center for Democracy and Technology, and he's held a number of positions there. Today, he acts as the senior counsel there. So I'm very pleased to have these two members of the PCLOB join us. And the program we're going to follow is Rachel and Jim will go back and forth on a number of points, and then we will open it up for questions from the callers. So with that, I believe Rachel is going to take the first turn, and I turn it over to you, Rachel.
Matthew, thank you very much, and thanks to the Federalist Society for hosting this call. Before we get to the substance of the board's report on the 702 program, I'd like to take just a minute to explain what the PCLOB is and what we do. Because we're so new, some of you may not be familiar with us. We are a brand new independent federal agency. We were created by Congress for two purposes. First, to oversee the executive branch's counterterrorism efforts to ensure that they appropriately protect privacy and civil liberties, and also to provide advice to the president and the intelligence agencies as they formulate counterterrorism policies in the first place. We are a permanent agency of the government. We're not an advisory committee. All five members of the board are appointed by the president. All of us were Obama appointees at the moment, and confirmed by the Senate to staggered six-year terms. The president is required to appoint at least two members from the opposite party. The statute provides that the chairman is a full-time government employee, and the other four members are not. So practically speaking, that means that the other four of us, including Jim and me, serve on the board in addition to whatever else we do for a living. Our jurisdiction under the statute is limited to only counterterrorism issues and to the federal government's actions. So we are not, for example, a regulatory agency overseeing the private sector. As I mentioned at the outset, we are brand new. Although Congress enacted our authorizing statute in 2007, it wasn't until 2012 that anyone was confirmed to serve on the board. And Jim is going to now talk a little bit more about what the board has done to date. And I'll say just to clarify what Matthew said at the beginning, we are going to go back and forth, but not in a tit-for-tat way, because actually our board's report was unanimous, and so we're just dividing up the subject matter of the board's report. Jim?
Rachel, thank you. And thank you, Christian and Matthew and the Federalist Society for sponsoring this teleforum. The board was, as Rachel said, first authorized quite a few years ago. It took a very long time to get us created. I had the privilege of being nominated three times to the board by two different presidents before finally any of us were confirmed. The four part-time members of the board were confirmed in August of 2012, and we had to start from scratch creating an independent federal agency within the executive branch, meaning that we had absolutely nothing. We had to deal with real estate and telephones and all the procedures around Sunshine and Government Act and FOIA and literally every single regulation and procedure that applies to a regulatory agency or to a federal agency. We struggled through that because our statute says that only the chairman can hire staff. Our chairman was not confirmed until May of 2013. Between August of 2012 and May of 2013, the four board members, though, began operations, both institutional and organizational, as well as substantive. Finally, when our chairman was, and by the way, we started before our chairman was confirmed, looking at the implementation of the FISA Amendments Act, and specifically Section 702, receiving initial briefings in depth on the program after we received our security clearances. All five members of the board hold security clearances. All of the staff is cleared. Our space where we work is a so-called SCIF, so we work in a classified environment. The chairman was confirmed in May 2013. Weeks later, the Snowden leaks began. And at that point, the board was essentially compelled to focus its efforts on the two major programs that Snowden leaked, the so-called 215 or business records telephone metadata program and the 702 FISA Amendments Act content acquisition program. The board issued a report on the Section 215 telephony metadata program in January of 2014. We then turned our full attention to Section 702 and issued our 702 report on 702 on July 2nd of this year. We had very full, complete cooperation from the intelligence community on our inquiries. If anything, that the volume of information that we received was daunting. Classified opinions of the FISA court, internal procedures and documents and other material from the intelligence agencies, particularly from the NSA, but also from other agencies involved, extensive briefings and meetings, and really had full cooperation. Both of our reports, the 215 report and the 702 report, were released totally in unclassified form. And I think we were particularly proud, I'm particularly proud, that the 702 report gave what is by far the fullest and clearest and most comprehensive description of the 702 program, by the way, the most complete and most detailed description of an signals intelligence program ever provided by any government in the world, ever. And in the process of drafting that report, our staff worked with the intelligence community to declassify multiple small facts, small pieces of information that helped us paint what I think is a very clear and comprehensive picture of that program. I will turn now back to Rachel, who will give a an overview of the program and some of the things that we found about it. Rachel?
Thanks, Jim. I'm going to give a very high-level overview of what the 702 program is and then get into some details. When we say the 702 program, what we're talking about is foreign intelligence collection under Section 702 of FISA, which was enacted in 2008 as part of the FISA Amendments Act. And FISA, of course, is the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, which governs how the government may collect foreign intelligence inside the United States. You may have heard the 702 program called the PRISM program in the press, and that is partially accurate, although not a full description. This is a highly complex program. The statutory text alone consumes several pages in Title 50 of the U.S. Code, and it's implemented through lengthy and very complex rules and procedures. Our board's report on the program was 150 pages long. But to boil it down to a manageable explanation, what 702 authorizes is collection of internet and telephone communications of specific non-U.S. persons located outside the United States whom the government believes will communicate foreign intelligence information. The FISA court reviews the government's procedures for choosing these individual targets, and the court reviews minimization procedures, which are the rules for handling information once it has been collected. The FISA court does not, though, review the government's individual decisions about which persons to target. So the program, as I just described it, has several important limitations on what the government may collect, and I want to touch on each of them separately. First, the government may never target Americans for surveillance under Section 702, no matter where they are located in the world. So if a U.S. citizen travels to Europe, the government may not collect their communications, even though they've left the United States. Second, the government may never target under 702 anyone located inside the United States, whether they're an American or not. So if a foreigner travels into the United States, the government may not collect their communications under Section 702 while they are here. There have been some inaccurate reports about how rigorous the government has to be when it's determining whether a target of surveillance is a foreigner located abroad. For example, some have said that the government uses a 51% likelihood test. Others have said that the government can look at one piece of information, such as the fact that a person speaks a foreign language, and not consider all other information that might suggest the person is an American or located inside the United States. Based on our review of the program, neither of those things is true. Under the rules governing the program, there is no 51% test, and the government must use due diligence in determining foreignness. It has to consider all the available information. If there's a circumstance where there is conflicting information about whether or not the person is inside or outside the United States, for example, the government has to look into that and resolve it and determine that the person is, in fact, located outside the United States before the person can be targeted for surveillance. Now, this does not mean that Americans' communications will never be collected, and this is one of the more contentious points about this program. If a targeted foreigner abroad communicates with an American, then that communication will be collected. That's referred to as incidental collection. This is not accidental or mistaken collection because it's an inevitable part of the program and one that Congress understood when it was enacting Section 702. It could also be extremely important from an intelligence perspective insofar as it could lead to discovering a domestic connection to a foreign terrorist plot. But nevertheless, it raises obvious privacy concerns and it has Fourth Amendment implications, which Jim is going to talk a little bit more about in a minute. The third limitation is that the government must select specific targets for surveillance, specific individuals whose communications they will collect. This is not a bulk collection program, contrary to what some people have understood. And finally, when selecting a particular foreigner abroad for surveillance, the government has to believe that he or she is likely to possess foreign intelligence information. So it's not just any foreigner abroad who can be targeted. The program operates with a compelled assistance of service providers. So that means, for example, that if the NSA wants to collect the emails of a particular person, the agency sends a directive to an internet service provider requiring the company to collect those emails and give them to the agency. The agency does not have direct access into the company's systems. There are two basic ways in which the communications are collected. The first is a so-called PRISM collection. In PRISM collection, the government sends a selector, and the selector is a term of art. There are a lot of confusing terms of art in this program, but selector means something like an email address or a telephone number. The government sends a selector to a service provider, and the company has to give the communications to or from that selector to the government. Telephone calls are not collected under PRISM. The second type of collection is known as upstream collection, and that's where telephone and electronic communications are collected from the backbone of the internet, again, with the compelled assistance of service providers, not by directly accessing company systems. There's one important way in which upstream collection differs from Prism collection, and that's what we refer to as about communications, which are collected upstream and not in Prism. An about communication is one in which the selector, the email address, for example, is within the communication, even if it's not in the to or from line. This occurs partly because of the way that upstream collection is conducted as a technical matter, by scanning a communication for the selector regardless of where it appears in the communication. So to give a practical example, if two non-targeted people refer to the targeted email address in the body of an email, it will be collected as an about communication. But this only happens for communications about the selector. So if rachel.brand@something.com is a targeted email and somebody else refers to that email in the body of an email, that would be collected. This is not used to scan for keywords or terms such as Al-Qaeda or explosives or something like that. So with that background, Jim is now going to explain some of the board's legal and policy conclusions about the program.
So as Rachel said, this is a very complex program, both in terms of its the statutory basis for it, the technological issues surrounding it, the number of agencies that have some role in it. But the board, in looking at it, identified certain core elements of the program. Namely, it acquires the communications of specifically targeted non-U.S. persons who are reasonably believed to be located outside the United States based upon, for foreign intelligence purposes, based upon a particularized determination that those persons are likely to communicate foreign intelligence. Those individuals are targeted using specific communications identifiers, like their telephone number or their email address. And all of this is subject to targeting rules and minimization rules that are approved by FISA court. And the program as a whole, in all of its different aspects, is subject to multiple layers of rigorous oversight. So that core program, the board found, was statutorily authorized, probably constitutional, I'll expand upon probably in a second, and effective. Statutorily authorized, it clearly fit, in our view, within the words of the statute that had been debated and adopted by Congress. If anything, in my view, it was at the somewhat narrower or more restrictive end of the spectrum of possible readings of the statute. Secondly, it was within the parameters of Fourth Amendment law as laid down primarily by the courts of appeal. That's why I put a little probably unconstitutional, because the Supreme Court hasn't ruled on anything like this. There is very little Supreme Court law on national security or foreign intelligence surveillance. What there is doesn't come anywhere close to addressing the specifics of this program. Even the circuit court opinions, including one very important opinion from the FISA Court of Review, do not directly address this program or a program specifically of this nature. The cases so far have had other elements of them, such as the agent of a foreign power standard, which is part of traditional FISA. The 702 program does not hinge on any belief that the targeted person is an agent of a foreign power. But the board worked from the premise that there is a foreign intelligence exception to the warrant requirement of the Fourth Amendment. We started from the premise that this program is covered by the Fourth Amendment, that the activity here, the surveillance, the acquisition of communications inside the United States through the compelled cooperation of the service providers is a Fourth Amendment event and must be analyzed through a Fourth Amendment framework. We then went on to the warrant clause. There are no particularized warrants here. It is programmatic approval by the court of the targeting and minimization procedures, but no prior or after the fact court approval or review of the specific targeting decisions or the specific decisions to collect the communications of a particular individual. So we looked at the question of the lack of a warrant, looked at the existing appeals court decisions, which had recognized some exception to the warrant clause. Obviously, if the warrant is not necessary, the reasonableness clause of the Fourth Amendment still applies, and therefore you must analyze the program under the reasonableness test. And the specific test you apply is a totality of the circumstances test, which looks not only at the rules for acquiring or first collecting or first obtaining the communications. And by the way, nothing in this program is based upon any distinction between interception, surveillance, acquisition, acquiring, or any, there are no tricks being played with those words here. When the government obtains a copy of the communications, that is the Fourth Amendment event. That is the acquisition. That is the sort of authorized and regulated event under this statute, even if, for example, those communications aren't looked at by anybody, and not all of them are looked at. We said, okay, that's a Fourth Amendment event. Warrant clause, the courts have recognized a national security exception, a foreign intelligence exception. Therefore, assess it under the reasonableness clause. Look at the totality of the circumstances. And we concluded that those core elements of the program, targeting persons reasonably believed to be abroad, under targeting rules that have proven to be very accurate in targeting persons outside the United States, relatively rarely is a mistake made. We found no abuse of the program. We found some unintentional mistakes, which are were relatively small in number. We concluded that the core of the program fits within the totality of circumstances test for reasonableness as it has been defined by the courts to date. Not trying to predict what the Supreme Court would do, but simply looking at where have the appellate courts been so far. We then said that there were certain elements of the program that push to the limits, to the closer to the edge of reasonableness. And I'll turn it back to Rachel to mention some of those. She's already mentioned the about collection, which is one of those. And it was our focus of our recommendations, and the focus really of the balance of our report was on looking at these elements of the program which did not go to its core, but which did then, under the totality of circumstances test, come close to the edge of reasonableness as we saw it. Just quickly, the last element of our review, statutorily authorized, constitutional within the scope of the reasonableness test as articulated by the courts to date in foreign intelligence cases. The third prong, effectiveness, as we've, I think Rachel mentioned, this one was almost, in my opinion at least, an easy one in terms of effectiveness. The program had proven to be effective in multiple ways, both in terms of identifying specific plots before they occurred, as well as in providing valuable intelligence, not only for counterterrorism, but also for foreign intelligence, counterproliferation, cybersecurity purposes. So this is a program that in its focus and intent and value goes far beyond counterterrorism, but in all of its aspects has proven to be, in our opinion, clearly and highly effective. Rachel?
Thanks, Jim. So as Jim mentioned, notwithstanding our conclusion that the program was lawful and effective, certain aspects of it gave us pause, those things around the margin that Jim mentioned, and that led us to make a number of targeted recommendations to tighten up the program's operation to bring it more squarely within the zone of reasonableness. I'll mention two of them and then turn it over to Jim again to explain the others. And we're not going to today go through every single one of our recommendations, but we'll hit the highlights. The first of those issues is incidental collection, which I mentioned earlier. This is the fact that if a surveillance target communicates with an American, those particular communications will be collected, even though the American couldn't himself be targeted for surveillance under Section 702. This has been one of the biggest public concerns about the program since it began. Members of Congress and others have asked the NSA to disclose how many communications involving an American have been collected, because it's very hard to assess how much the 702 program impacts privacy rights without having that information. The government has maintained that it doesn't know the answer, and it can't provide an accurate number because it doesn't know the nationality of every person with whom a targeted foreigner communicates, and it can't investigate that fact for every one of the millions of communications collected under the program. The government also points out that it may be a greater privacy intrusion if they had to conduct an investigation into every person whose communications were incidentally collected, when many of them might otherwise never be looked into. For our part as the board, we appreciate the difficulty the government faces, but we do believe it's important as a policy matter to have a better understanding of how many Americans' communications are being incidentally collected. And we think there are certain types of information that could be collected that would provide some insight into this, even if they wouldn't provide a complete answer. So we recommend that the government begin measuring 5 discrete types of information about the collected communications, including, for example, the number of telephone calls where one phone number is located inside the U.S., and the number of Internet communications collected upstream that involve a U.S. IP address on either end. So we think providing that information to Congress and, where possible, to the public will at least give some picture and help us understand the extent of privacy intrusion. The second issue of concern relates to about collection, which both Jim and I have mentioned. Now, the government concedes that about collection is more likely to sweep in communications where neither communicant is located outside the United States. The government uses a variety of mechanisms, including IP filters, to try to screen out those U.S.-to-U.S. communications, but those measures are not always perfect. So to address that, we made 2 recommendations. First, we recommended that the government frequently assess whether it can improve its filtering mechanisms to prevent that inadvertent collection of non-targeted communications. There are constant developments in technology which may make those improvements possible. And the government may want to consult with private sector experts in addition to its own IT experts. I mentioned earlier that one type of about collection occurs when 2 untargeted people send an email with a targeted email address in the body of the email. There are also other technical contexts in which about communication occurs, some of which remain classified. Our second recommendation about collection was that the government should review all of those contexts in which about collection occurs to see whether it would be possible to avoid some of them, and we look forward to continuing to work with the government as they study that. Back over to Jim.
Another issue that we identified had to do with the targeting procedures. In order to target a person under Section 702, 2 basic criteria must be satisfied. First, the person must be a non-U.S. person located outside the United States. And secondly, the surveillance must be conducted to collect foreign intelligence information. On the first of those, we found that the guidelines were quite specific and that the process for reviewing those decisions was quite rigorous. And as I mentioned, we found as well that the outcome of that process was highly accurate. There had been some reporting in the press that this was a 51% determination reasonably believed, and that's not at all the way that it works. So we were there's a vetting process, there's several layers of checks that occur to make sure that the target is a non-U.S. person located outside the United States. So we found a high level of confidence in the sort of written procedures and the implementing process. On the foreign intelligence value or foreign intelligence purpose determination, we found that the guidelines targeting procedures were less clear and that the oversight and review process on that was not as rigorous. And since, among other reasons, the whole foreign intelligence purpose is part of the premise of the program. It's the element of the program that allows it to be conducted without a particularized warrant. We felt that the recommended that the NSA targeting procedure should be revised to specify criteria for determining the expected foreign intelligence value of a particular target and to require a written explanation of the basis for that determination sufficient to demonstrate that it was, in fact, likely to return, that the targeting was likely to return foreign intelligence. We did not think that this required legislative change. There's no need to amend the statute to do this. The guidelines are adopted by the executive branch. They are submitted to the court. We recommended that in the next round of annual certifications that new guidelines be submitted to the court and that the court would review them as part of its constitutional analysis of the program, which it's required to do under the statute and probably required to do independently as a constitutional matter in any case. And the written explanation that the government has, what they call a targeting tool, which is in essence got a series of menus and some checkboxes and some blank spaces where the analysts making the targeting decision and the supervisors reviewing it enter some very minimal but basic information. Both they do it on the foreignness determination, and we recommended that they do it with equal detail. Really, we're talking one sentence on the foreign intelligence purpose. And I believe that change, if implemented, could have significant value in terms of increasing the value, the output of the program, as well as ensuring that it remains true to its constitutional roots in the foreign intelligence process. Secondly, we grappled at great length with the question of querying the database of collected 702 information, querying that database using identifiers of U.S. persons. So again, the government cannot target U.S. persons, but because of the nature of the program, it is expected and intended and inevitable that communications to, from, or about U.S. persons will be acquired. And that incidental, what it's called, incidental acquisition, in our view, was lawful, it was constitutional, it was an intended part of, an inevitable and unavoidable part of the program. But then the question became, when can the government go into that database and extract communications to, from, or about Americans using the names of the communications identifiers of Americans, Americans who could not have been targeted under the program in the first place. And yet now, after the fact, analysts can go and extract some subset of communications of an American who might be in contact with people overseas. The board recommended that for the FBI, there should be a clarification of the FBI minimization procedures around the actual practice at the Bureau for conducting those queries. We found that what was stated in the written procedures did not quite match the practice as it was being conducted. We found nothing wrong per se with the practices being conducted, but we recommended that the rules on paper and the practice need to be aligned. And we said that there should be some additional limits placed on the FBI's use and dissemination of 702 data in connection with non-foreign intelligence matters, criminal matters not having a foreign intelligence aspect to them. There were a variety of opinions on the board on what those additional limits should look like. There was a variety of opinions on the board about going beyond that. Our core recommendation was unanimous, and we had a series of additional views. Two members of the board wanted to see FISA court approval. Two members of the board were strongly opposed to that. Once it was clear we weren't going to reach consensus on that, I did not deeply engage in that. But in essence, I I sided with the board members who felt that judicial prior approval of U.S. person queries was not necessary or appropriate. I think the question remains open for further consideration. What should be the limits around U.S. person queries at the various agencies, CIA, FBI, and NSA, which acquire some 702 data and query it under internal procedures. That basically summarizes the core of our report. We had a couple of other recommendations. Again, the report is public online, pclob.gov, but I think it's time to turn it over to Q&A. Matthew?
Great. Thank you, Jim, and thank you, Rachel, for walking us through what is necessarily a quick gallop through a very comprehensive report. I've read the report, and I was impressed by its depth and its clarity. It's a great reference piece on exactly what this program does. And in reading the report, there was one question that was of interest to me, or there are actually many, but I'll ask one and then we'll get to the callers. And that's in connection with Recommendation 10, which Rachel mentioned briefly, and the idea that, you know, there should be, you know, a comprehensive methodology or metric for assessing the effectiveness of the program or the programs, I guess, is how the recommendation reads. And in reading the report, the board clearly came down on the side that this program is effective. And I was just wondering, was there a methodology that you all adopted that might be of use to the intelligence community, or if there wasn't a clear methodology adopted by the board, is there something that you have in mind that would be maybe the basis for a metric or a methodology that the intelligence community should be considering?
Sure. Thanks, Matthew. I can take a first crack at this. The recommendation that you just mentioned, I didn't go into it too much, so happy to go into it now. We basically recommended that the intelligence community create a method for across programs, sort of going forward as a general matter, assessing efficacy, because frankly, assessing efficacy was easy with respect to Section 702 because it's effective on a number of metrics. If you read our report, a number of specific terrorist plots have been discovered. You know, terrorists previously unknown to the government have been discovered through intelligence collected under 702. 702-derived information has made it into high-level intelligence briefings, you know, frequently. So on pretty much any available metric, 702 is effective. So that was easy. We had a harder time assessing efficacy in our 215 report, the bulk telephony metadata program report. A majority of the board concluded that the program was not effective, or at least not effective enough to warrant its privacy intrusion. And I had some misgivings about that, the majority's recommendation there. But that report went through a variety of potential metrics. You could look at plots thwarted. You could look at terrorists discovered. You could look at the extent to which reporting gets into, or you know, intelligence gathered gets into intelligence reports, such as the president's daily brief. You could look at whether intelligence gathered enables the government to not waste resources on some futile exercise, but rather direct resources to something more productive. So there are lots of different metrics. And, you know, frankly, it's important to consider all of them when you're looking at a program. But really, what we were getting at is that although there are parts of the government that look at efficacy of programs from a budgeting perspective, for example, it didn't seem to us that the government is routinely engaging in sort of a step back and say, is this program effective? You know, do its privacy implications and its effectiveness match up? Should we keep doing this? And we think that that would be useful going forward for the government to do itself, not just for somebody in a post hoc review like what we did to conduct it. Jim, do you have anything else about that?
This is clearly a forward-looking recommendation that is going to be an issue that's going to come up for us again and again, and will come up for the intelligence community and policymakers. And I think everybody knows that this is one of the hard problems of assessing effectiveness, certainly from my own perspective. You might ask, why is the Privacy and Civil Liberties Board getting into questions of effectiveness at all? And I think from my perspective, you know, a highly effective program might be acceptable even if it has highly intrusive impact on privacy. On the other hand, a ineffective or program of limited effectiveness but still impact on privacy, you might say, well, this is not worth the intrusion. To some extent, that may go to the reasonableness test constitutionally. It also goes to the whole question of priorities. And I think the shared recognition, including within the intelligence community, that now, more than a decade after 9/11, we need to have a process of routinely and periodically taking a look both at individual programs as well as holistically about, are we looking in the right places? Are we collecting the right kinds of information? Are we conducting the right kinds of programs to meet the threat that we're facing, but in a way that's cost-effective, both with a very broad definition of effectiveness and a very broad definition of cost, but still that kind of assessment needs to be made. Up till now, it has been only barely begun, and we were trying to push along that process. We'll be trying to figure it out and contribute to it ourselves, but also, in a way, trying to prod the intelligence community to do even more in that area.
Great. Well, thank you both. Christian, I think we're now at the stage where we can open it up to questions from those that have dialed in.
Great. Well, for our audience, we'll open the floor to your questions. In a moment, you will hear a prompt that will say the floor mode is on. And after that, to request the floor, enter star and then the pound key. So again, to ask a question, press star and then the pound key. Looks like our audience is being a little, we've got over 50 people on the line. Looks like our audience is being a little bit shy.
Well, I'm happy to keep asking questions, but I certainly want to give the callers a chance.
Well, go ahead. Maybe maybe if you've got one, a question to throw out there while our audience thinks of a few, and I'll let you know afterwards if we have anybody dial on for a question.
Sure. Thanks. One of the other questions I wanted to have both Rachel and Jim comment on is the role of the FISA court, or FISC as it's sometimes called. I know that the report touched on this and it gets picked up in recommendations 4 and 5. But I'm just curious as to, you know, what your, you know, was there consensus within the board? I mean, it looks from the report that there was general consensus from the board about an enhanced role for the FISC, but I'm just wondering sort of how you approached your thinking about that, and sort of if you could walk us through the process of how you landed on the recommendations you did.
Yeah, this is Jim. I'll take that first. And in our 215 report, which was issued in January, our report on the telephony metadata program, we spent considerable time and had several chapters on the operations of the FISC. So in a way, we had bifurcated our work here, had done 215 and FISC procedures and operations in our first report in January, and then 702 specifically here. The January report made it clear that the board sees the FISC as a critical component of the system of checks and balances that we've created around the exercise of foreign intelligence powers in the United States. And we tried to debunk some of the criticism of the court as a rubber stamp. We pointed out that the FISA court in its treatment of the particularized applications, the so-called Title I FISA applications or traditional FISA, that it's actually rejects or turns back for more work applications at a higher rate than the average federal or state court judge does in considering regular wiretap or search warrant requests. But we also noted that, and judges of the FISA court had pointed this out to us in testimony at the hearings we held, that the role of the FISA court after 9/11, and particularly in the period around 2005 and thereafter, the role of the FISA court changed dramatically. It retained its core traditional particularized warrant type application role, but it also took on a programmatic role, almost a supervisory or regulatory role, which got it deep into ongoing questions about technological, legal, constitutional, and compliance aspects of surveillance programs, particularly the 215 program and the 702 program. And we have made no recommendations at all and have, in essence, endorsed and supported the role of the FISA court as traditionally conducted. But in response to, including remarks made to us by former FISA court judges, we recommended some, I think, relatively modest changes to the practices of the court as they relate to this supervisory and compliance role surrounding ongoing supervision of ongoing surveillance programs. In this report, particularly, we urged the government to make what you might think of as a return to submit to the FISA court. There's this large package of information that goes to them every year for reauthorization of the program, to include in that some sampling of the targeting decisions made to give the court a little bit more granular feel. The court is very, very deep into the details of these programs, absolutely no doubt about it. And this was a recommendation that they get a little additional window into the operation of the program that would inform their reauthorization and their consideration of the program going forward.
Matthew, just to answer your question about unanimity, the recommendations about the FISA court in both of our reports were unanimous, both in the 215 report and in the 702 report. And the in the 215 report, where we made recommendations about a special advocate to present arguments to the court in cases of particular importance or when the court might be authorizing a new bulk collection program or something like that, like Jim said, we're fairly modest. And it's important to remember that the devil is really in the details here. There have been a wide variety of different recommendations, different bills on the Hill, different recommendations from NGOs and others about how to provide sort of a third-party voice into the FISC's proceedings. And it's really important to get it right because it's a process that works quite well right now. As Jim said, the court's not a rubber stamp, and you wouldn't want to create a situation where the court couldn't act expeditiously in true national security emergencies and things like that. So important to get it right. One thing that I have just taken note of a number of times is there have been some declassified FISA court opinions that have been released over the last several months that showed circumstances where the FISA court slapped the government and said that it was doing something wrong and needed to change its procedures. And folks often use those as examples for why the government's doing something wrong. But another thing to take away from that is that because these are FISA court opinions that were written at a time well before the leaks. And the reason that the court was issuing the decision is because the government came to the court and reported itself and said to the court, look, we're doing something that we did not inform you of. We need to make this known to you. And then the court deals with it. So that's sort of an example of how, even though these proceedings are ex parte, the government takes very seriously its responsibility to be candid with the FISA court, and the FISA court takes very seriously its responsibility to oversee the programs.
Yeah, no, I think I agree with that. Christian, do we have any questions lined up?
Yeah, we actually had three questions jump on the line and about 10 minutes left, so we can go right to the questions now.
Great.
Hi, Matthew Kirst, attorney in Virginia. I have a little bit of like a two-pronged question. You were talking about one element of your recommendations were the analyzing the efficacy of these programs, and I'm curious if I haven't had an opportunity to look at the report, I'm sorry, but does that efficacy consider, like, the changing landscape of Intel in this age? Like, I recall reading when they captured Osama bin Laden that they saw a bunch of USB drives and the different ways that Al-Qaeda were communicating. Does your report go into the changing landscape on that respect? And also then on the other side of it, with the FISA court, is there an overview process of seeing whether, you mentioned that the FISA court is not a rubber stamp, but is there any data that are showing that it is not a rubber stamp as opposed to, you know, it actually, is it a matter of the government only presenting, you know, good cases to the court, therefore it passes a lot of, you know, it affirms a lot of the warrants, or is it a matter of the court actually being rubber stamped? Thank you very much.
Jim or Rachel, who would like to take first crack at that?
Let me quickly do the first one, which is the changing landscape in terms of technology. Our report did not specifically address that, although we're acutely aware of it, as are the intelligence agencies and the digital age both presents opportunities for communication among terrorists and others who would do harm to the United States or who have interests adverse to our countries. And at the same time, it obviously presents a avenue for the government to collect intelligence. We alluded to that double-edged sword, in, I think, in both of our reports, but we did not try to go deeply into the technology in our report. We did try to understand the technology of how some of the surveillance occurred and actually spent some considerable time with that, and we have one or two people on staff who are technically more adept than the board members are and can help us walk through that. That will continue to be a major interest and issue for the board, particularly if we get into, as we are planning to some extent, into issues around cybersecurity, where clearly the nation's critical infrastructures face a threat, and clearly the intelligence agencies have a role to play, and the rapid changes in technology are critical to that. On your second question, the FISA court, again, we found there's an extremely robust process there. There's a lot of back and forth between the government and the court. Of course, all warrant applications are ex parte. I think in the criminal context, whether it's Title III or a physical search warrant, 99% of those are approved. The probable cause standard is a real standard. It means something. Having to go before a judge and lay that out clearly means something, and that's a serious hurdle that on the criminal side and on the intelligence side, people take extremely seriously. And as I said, if anything, the FISA court is more probing, I think, when it gets to the programmatic activities, far, far more probing than a court would be on a traditional search warrant or Title III criminal wiretap application. Rachel?
No, I think that covers it. I know there are some other questions on the line.
Yeah, Christian, maybe we bring up the next question, please.
All right.
Hi, this is John Sullivan at Google. Jim stated as a premise that the Fourth Amendment event generally occurs at collection. And I'm wondering whether that is to suggest that once the intelligence community has a set of data, including some that was incidentally collected, the posing of queries against that data should never be considered as an insular Fourth Amendment event.
John, good to hear your voice. Under the totality of circumstances test, the how you use the data is part of the consideration of the program. So what we said in our report was, at least for this kind of a program, you look at, in essence, the life cycle of the information in assessing reasonableness. So we assessed, you start from the point of collection, but, and this is the government's position as well, that what makes warrantless collection constitutional and what makes it reasonable is the after-the-fact limits on searching, querying, using, disseminating, retaining. So your minimization guidelines, which cover those areas, retention, querying, use, and dissemination, your minimization guidelines and the limits that you set on the after-the-fact queries contribute to the constitutionality of the program as a whole, including the initial collection. But the after-the-fact uses and limits on the data do have to be reviewed. And whether that's a, you know, a separate search, extremely complicated. Some of you know, John, you well know, it's now being posed in the so-called Microsoft Ireland case, which is a non-national security case, but where the government has argued that a search occurs when the government looks at the data, not when the government gets the data. That may be inconsistent with the position that the government takes in the FISA context.
As usual, Jim covers it well. I would just add that there is, you know, it was a challenge for the board to address the Fourth Amendment questions because there is just surprisingly little case law. I mean, there is obviously case law and special needs exception to the warrant requirement, but in the national security context in particular, there's just very little to go on. So we, you know, we did our best applying the totality of the circumstances test set out by the court, but it really is, much of this is an open question.
Christian, I think we might have time for one more question.
And that goes well because we've got one more question on the line. Hopefully we can get in very quickly.
David Emerson, a society member in Berkeley, California. The relationship between the terrorists and those who oppose them is in some ways comparable to kind of a cat and mouse game, but they're very intelligent actors, and each side responds to the other's acts in seeking intelligence or preventing intelligence, frustrating intelligence being collected, and learning from the actions of the other actors. So it's anything but a static situation. It's a dynamic situation. It's evolving. You know, the tendency that as surveillance is ratcheted up, there is a corresponding driving down and obfuscation and deepening in its difficulty of obtaining the surveillance. So all these parties counteract each other's efforts, and the ratcheting up effect is leading in a direction. And my question has to do about, does the report address where this is going in the long term? And, you know, you can imagine a situation where, at a time where technology and recipes that terrorists could use for creating weapons of mass destruction, it's easier to obtain, it's easier to wield by a smaller group, certainly non-state operators, very small groups, potentially even a lone terrorist, one with a degree in molecular biology, cooking up a batch of poliovirus in his or her kitchen sink. So does the report take a forward-looking approach, let's say 15, 20 years down the road, where that's the type of threat that we're dealing with, and where our survival at some point depends on us relinquishing traditional notions of privacy in almost their entirety, and viewing privacy more as an exception rather than a rule?
Well, this report is on a very specific program, and as Jim described, the challenges we had getting ourselves stood up, and at the very beginning we were in sort of a one project at a time mode. We've now hired some more staff and can get beyond that. But the short answer is no. I mean, this report looks at the 702 program, and that's it pretty much. But your question relates to another issue that the board has been thinking about and that we intend to look at in the future, which is the whole question of what privacy is, because I have to say that I find it very hard to make an assessment between two if you get really down in the weeds and you want to talk about whether the NSA's minimization procedure should provide X or Y, and you don't have any general agreement about what privacy is, what interests are protected, what constitutes a greater or lesser privacy intrusion, it's very hard to make those specific public policy choices. And then obviously we are in a changing world. Even when you think about the Fourth Amendment reasonable expectation of privacy standard, what expectation of reasonable is objective and sort of a broad societal thing which changes over time. So this is sort of a broad, very interesting and very difficult question that we intend to grapple with more generally in the future.
Amen to that.
Well, I think that's a great place to end. Again, I thank our two panelists, Rachel Brand and Jim Dempsey, for joining us today. I thought it was a very thought-provoking conversation. I think if folks that have been listening have not yet read the report, it is available at pclub.org. Do I have that right?
P-L-O-B, yeah.
It's yep. .gov, though, not .org.
I'm sorry, .gov. And the report's available for download in PDF form. I think it's a very readable report. And if you are pressed for time, it's got a very helpful executive summary at the beginning of it that can at least get you a little bit deeper on the topic because it's an interesting topic. So, again, thanks to both of you for joining us. And with that, Christian, I will turn it over to you to close us out.
Great. On behalf of the Federal Society, thank you to both board members as well as Matthew for moderating today's call. Thanks to our audience. And you can find this podcast of this call as well as our other calls at fedsoc.org. And until next time, we're adjourned. Thank you all very much.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.